Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with journalist Joe Strupp about how the media covers Donald Trump. Strupp says that they risk losing the modest amount of credibility that they still have. Then we'll be joined by Imani Gandhi from Rewire News to talk about the right's bizarre panic over bathrooms, over who pees where. She's also going to talk some law at you, after which you will understand that the Obama administration was not acting in a tyrannical manner when Department of Education issued a guidance that schools should let kids use the facilities that match the gender that they express. But first, a few items you may have missed. The Never Trump movement is going great. Last weekend, Bill Kristol, who vetted Sarah Palin for John McCain in 2008 and decided she'd be a great person to have just a heartbeat away from the presidency, announced on Twitter that the Never Trumps were finally going to draft an independent conservative candidate to run against Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. He said their choice would be a great candidate with a strong team and a lot of support. And then this week, he announced that it was, in fact, third-tier wingnut columnist David French. You probably never heard of him, but he writes a lot of silly culture war stuff for National Review. And here is a clip of French.
So what do you do if Donald Trump does indeed win the nomination?
What do? I vote for Donald Trump. I'm not one of these Republicans who said, or conservatives who says, well, I'm just going to take my ball and go home.
He's voting for Trump. Sad trombone. Now, that clip was from before Kristol's announcement, and French is considering doing it for the good of the nation or whatever. But then all these other Never Trump conservatives were like, hey, Bill Kristol, we never talked about drafting this National Review columnist that nobody has ever heard of. We were thinking of a prominent person like Mitt Romney, and they all got mad. So that's happening. Meanwhile, do you remember televangelist Jim Baker, Jim and Tammy Faye? He cried when he was convicted of multiple counts of fraud, or maybe when it emerged that he'd paid off Jessica Hahn to keep her from publicly accusing him of rape. Maybe he cried when that scandal broke, or maybe he cried both times. I'm not sure. Fun fact, he actually served part of his prison sentence in a cell with Lyndon LaRouche. They must have made quite the team in prison. Anywho, via Right Wing Watch, Jim Baker laid out the choices conservatives face this week on his TV show because they gave him another TV show.
I think the church needs a dialogue because we got two choices. We've got Donald Trump or Mrs. Clinton. So what are we going to do? And you say there's others out there that believe that we may not even get to the election, that there's going to be a martial law declared because some event may take. This is what people, some have actually prophesied this. So we'll see. We'll see if it's of God or not. And Ronald Reagan, I would like to title it The Day Ronald Reagan Became a Prophet. And I want the world to hear. I don't know why I can't get my hands on it. I saw it once. It's locked up away from me. And I just think it's time that that tape be seen, because it will shock America. He prophesied where America would be now. I want you to hear it with your own ears. I don't expect you to believe me.
See, Ronald Reagan, the prophet, prophesies this stuff. He'd love for you to listen to the tape of Ronald Reagan prophesizing, but he doesn't have it. You'll have to trust him. Trust Jim Baker. And here's his guest, Michael Snyder, who knows what's really going on.
You know, I've said it before on the program that I believe that the elite are going to move heaven and earth to do whatever is necessary to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. And
yes.
So, you know, we've already seen them spend insane amounts of money, and they'll continue to
hundreds
do that.
Hundreds of millions of dollars.
But if they have to go to
could feed the poor and the hungry for that amount of money.
If they have to go to far greater extremes than just spending money against him, they will do that, because that's how
they
operate.
Michael. Snyder, what do you think they might do? How desperate is it for them to destroy Donald Trump?
I believe they will go to any length, including, I let us pray for the safety of him and his family.
Yeah.
First of all.
Yes.
Secondly, They are certainly not above launching false flag attacks. I don't know if you're familiar with false flag, but the idea is that you attack yourself and you blame it on someone else, creating some type of disaster, emergency, things of that nature.
That's been done right here at Morningside. I've had that done to me by some people.
False flag, folks. Evangelical Christianity meets Alex Jones. It's a marriage made in hell, clearly. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back.
Call me Mr. Pitiful. Baby, that's my name now. Oh, call me Mr. Pitiful. That's how I got my fame. But people just don't understand what makes a man feel so blue. Ooh, they call me Mr. Pitiful, 'cause I lost someone just like you.
Lost a legend this week. Muhammad Ali, born Cassius Clay, died on Friday at age 74. As some may say that Joe Louis or Sugar Ray Robinson or Henry Robinson or Mike Tyson was the greatest, but Ali was the greatest. Ali was not only a great athlete, but he was also a dedicated civil rights activist. And before his radical side gets whitewashed in a wave of puff pieces, I want to play a few clips for you. Here he is wondering why Jesus is white on a BBC show in 1971.
I always wondered when I went to church on Sundays. I've always been one to, I'm not just a boxer. I do a lot of reading, a lot of studying. I ask questions. I travel these countries. I watch how their people live and I learn. And I always ask my mother, I said, Mother, how come is everything white? I said, why is Jesus white with blonde hair and blue eyes? Why is the Lord's Supper all white men? Angels are white, Pope and the Mary and every, even the angels. I said, Mother, when we die, do we go to heaven? She said, naturally, we go to heaven. I said, well, what happened to all the black angels when they took the pictures? I said, oh, I know. If the white folks was in heaven too, then the black angels were in the kitchen preparing the milk and honey. So listen, you quit saying that, boy. I was always curious.
And this is a clip from the same show. The host asks him if he wants to be president, and here's what Muhammad Ali had to say again back in 1971.
You mentioned President Nixon there. I was reading a piece that Norman Mailer wrote about you recently where he described you as the second most prominent American, second most prominent after Nixon. We might dispute that. But would you like to be president?
No.
No?
No, sir. Too dangerous.
like, in other words, here's a ship. People are dancing on the ship. A lot of money's on the ship. A lot of food's on the ship. And I cannot integrate on the ship. I cannot have equality on the ship. I'm just in the galley working. And I never could get up and see the captain of the ship. Now, all of a sudden, the man tells me, say, come on down. I'll lead you out of the galley. I want you to come up here and here, have something to drink. What do you want? And giving me number one spot. From the galley to the number one spot, I said, this ship must be sinking. Why is he... Why is he so nice to me now? What moved him to call me up here? Black men have been males now. One might be the president. America's in too much trouble. I don't want that job now. Something to think about, ain't it?
Again, he was a radical. Here he is speaking out against interracial marriage in 1968. This is a mixed race crowd at a university. There are hippies in the background, white hippies, and his comments make some of them visibly uncomfortable, you can tell.
Any white woman in this audience today, any white man in this audience today, in their right minds, don't want little black boys and little black white black girls coming around your home, schools, and churches looking to marry your sons and daughters, and in return introducing your grandchildren as little half-brown, kinky-haired Negro children. No intelligent black man in this audience, no intelligent black woman in this audience want little white boys and little white girls coming to marry their sons and daughters and in return introducing your grandchildren as little half-white, green-eyed, blonde-haired Negroes. We are not seeking to lose our identity in blood mixing and our beautiful black African history. We don't hate you. We don't hate those of you who are white. We just want to stay black. We love my color. I just love myself.
And there were actually several instances when he made this call for black and white racial purity. You may have heard this one. It might be his most famous political speech. Let's take a listen to Ali talking about why he is not going to go to Vietnam.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. What I'm going to shoot them for what? How can I go shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? I'll just take me to jail.
And here's Ali in a heated debate with like a young Republican type on a college campus.
I'm saying you talking about me about some draft and all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now right here fighting you. If I'm gonna die, you my enemy. My enemies are white people, not Viet Congs or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
And Muhammad Ali claimed conscientious objector status, but was convicted of draft dodging in 1967. His boxing license was suspended. He was stripped of his titles, and he would be unable to box for 3 years. He lost three of his prime years. Eventually, the Supreme Court overturned his conviction in an 8-0 decision. Before his conviction was overturned, New York Times columnist William Roden wrote, and I quote, "Ali's actions changed my standard of what constituted an athlete's greatness. Possessing a killer jump shot or the ability to stop on a dime was no longer enough. What were you doing for the liberation of your people? What were you doing to help your country live up to the covenant of its founding principles?" Muhammad Ali, dead at age 74. We lost a great man this week. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Joe Strupp. Did I mention that Muhammad Ali could sing? This is his 1963 rendition of Stand By Me.
Come
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, I've been pretty sanguine about the election this fall. Any major party candidate can win, right? That's just the nature of our deeply polarized electorate. Authoritarian goofball Donald Trump has certainly surprised us in the past. But, you know, he could win, but he probably won't. There aren't enough missing white voters to make up for the massive mobilization that he's going to inspire among people of color. He's clearly unqualified. We say that often about candidates, but it's really obvious in this case. And I think his toxic misogyny is going to affect some women who normally vote Republican in a visceral way that transcends politics. But the one thing that gives me pause, my big worry, is that political reporters are so deeply accustomed to treating competing political statements as he said, she said, they're so used to characterizing a race as cleaving along traditional party lines between Democrats and Republicans, and they're so unaccustomed to serving as kind of real-time fact checkers. That's not their job. And I worry that all of this is going to come together and they're going to end up normalizing the candidacy of Donald Trump, of a racist demagogue, of a candidate who is many things, but not a traditional Republican. Anyway, my next guest is Joe Strupp. He's a veteran journalist who is currently a senior reporter for Media Matters. Joe had a piece this week at mediamatters.org. You can find it at mediamatters.org. It's titled, Veteran Journalists, Trump Coverage Devastating for News Credibility. Joe Strupp, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Great. Great to be here.
So you looked at the issue from the perspective of the media's credibility. What's your take on the media's coverage of Trump?
Yeah, we've done a lot of coverage of Trump going back to when he first started. And you're right, a lot of people were sort of surprised where he went. But there was a lot of media culpability in this, where they both gave him a lot of press time. We did research that showed he got overwhelming amount of time on the air, mostly on the cable channels, the cable news channels, compared to other candidates in the Republican primary and in the Democratic primary. Part of this was due to the fact that he would really call in and be made available a lot. But when you call in, you are not subject to the kind of scrutiny that you are when you're live. So a lot of places stop that, although a few have continued to do it. But part of that was this idea that Trump is entertainment and he is ratings. And much of the news, whether it's views on a website or ratings on cable channels or broadcast channels, you know, if they get ratings, that's more important than ever, even in news. So a couple of people, including Les Moonves, the head of CBS, were bragging that he was bringing them ratings, and he even said, it may not be good for America, but it's good, damn good for CBS. The ratings.
I think he said it's bad for America.
He said it may not be good for America, but okay, it's damn good for CBS. Jeff Zucker, the head of CNN, also was complaining that there was too much hand-wringing, as he put it, about how they were handling Trump. But Trump was getting a lot of attention because he was bringing ratings, and that's not what news outlets are supposed to do. They're supposed to have news judgment. Not only were they putting him on more than anyone else, but they were not scrutinizing him until just recently. And I wonder how much that will continue, given that he both antagonizes the press and shoots back, and they want the ratings. It'll be very interesting to see how the general election moves forward. But you also raise an important issue that this he said, she said, or what we call false equivalency, where many outlets are trying to put him and Hillary Clinton in similar positions. Now, they both have high unfavorable ratings, that's true. Trump's are much higher, but to try to claim that they are similar candidates is just inaccurate. Hillary Clinton has a totally different approach. She's a different candidate. She's a different person. She's got more experience. She's got different experience. Yes, she has some problems, but to sort of compare her to Trump and say that they're sort of similar is another fallacy that a lot of the press falls into, because it's an easy thing. My complaint with the press, as I've said before, is not so much bias, because I don't think the bias is there that many people want to believe, at least not in the good news outlets, but laziness and greed. And the greed comes from wanting ratings or views or clicks and putting in and up anything that will get it. And Trump is a key person related to that, and he's also very good at it. You know, he comes from the business world, but he also comes from the reality TV world, which lives off of ratings and off of shocking and getting attention. And the way he lies, you know, we've written stories that said he lies 70% of the time, according to PolitiFact and the Washington Post's fact checker column, far and away more than any other candidate on either side. So you're both giving him attention more than others, and you're not able to really check his facts because he lies so often. So that's the credibility concern that a lot of people had in the story that we put up this week.
PolitiFact found that, as you mentioned, Trump lies. It's either false or pants on fire.
Yes.
70%. And for Hillary Clinton, that was 14%. And then the other problem with the false equivalency is, like, you may not like Hillary Clinton, but nobody denies that she is within the mainstream of Democratic politics. She's in the mainstream of American politics, and she has an enormous amount of political experience, hands-on political experience. Trump's ability to manipulate the media to set the agenda to get attention goes way back before his reality TV show. I'm a New Yorker in my mid-40s, and I remember him, you know, getting headlines on the Washington, in the New York Post, and the Daily News as a kid. You know, he was always able to do this. So let me ask you this, Joe. The media, they are private corporations. They're in business. They're in the market for ratings. They're not going to stop relentlessly covering the GOP nominee. So how would you like to see that coverage change?
No, they should relentlessly cover him, and relentlessly cover Hillary Clinton, and relentlessly cover anyone else. But relentlessly covering means digging up facts, asking tough questions, demanding answers. If you find a lie, exposing the lie, not fawning or giving attention to everything they do just to get ratings. And I still say, yes, news outlets are businesses, and maybe that's one of the problems we have in this country, is that they become too much of a business. I'm a news guy first. I'm not a big fan of any politician, but I am a big fan of accuracy and fair coverage. And to see how the press in this country has gone to the point where they'll do anything for ratings is not what news outlets are supposed to do. We have, you know, we're the first amendment to the Constitution. We're probably the only profession that has true constitutional protection. And there's a reason for that, because it's a public trust, a public service, where you are supposed to focus on getting good, accurate news out first thing. And the ratings and profitability and all should be secondary. And that has not been the case, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's the fourth estate, because it really is seen as an integral institution for our democracy. Matt Iglesias was very excited to see CNN run a chyron that read, "Trump, I never said Japan should have nukes." And then in parentheses, it reads, "He did." This is something that Iglesias over at Vox.com thought was a really big step for CNN. So what about speed? What about Trump's ability to influence the news cycle with a single misspelled tweet. And I ask this because one of the reasons the Republicans were unable to knock him out of the primaries is that he was operating at Twitter speed while they were kind of vetting their responses through campaign consultants and, you know, the communication staff. So he was always able to get in a flurry of punches while they were still trying to get their footing. And his tweets, you know, they've gotten as much coverage as, like, I don't know, the Super Bowl, some of them. Are journalists even prepared for something like this? How can they keep on track when he's diverting the daily, he's diverting the media's attention from big stories with attack tweets, with insulting tweets?
Well, I think the tweets are, that's news. I mean, you can cover the tweets, you can cover what he does. He does handle, and did in the primary, handle, handle the social media and the tweeting and the Facebook and everything much better than others because he was so adept at it. And you do have to cover it because a lot of things he tweets are among the most newsworthy things in terms of showing the way he operates. But you do also have to show some editorial judgment and ask the tough questions and not let him sort of drive the conversation. You have to say, okay, he did. When we've written about his tweets and we've written about other news members of the media who tweet, but you can't just follow every little thing and sort of be his secretary and just sort of take down what he says and send it out. You have to have some news judgment. You have to study what it means. You have to report what it means. You have to see comment on what he does, and you can't just focus on that. You do have to focus on what's his plan, what's his proposal, what's this or that that he's going to do in office, and there's been very little of that. Now, it's, again, starting to come around. I think a lot of it is during the primary, there's a lot of sort of coverage of the quick and loud approach. Now you have two nominees. I think you're starting to see the scrutiny of Trump. The press conference earlier this week was a good sign of both reporters willing to grill him, but also how he reacts, you know, calling him names, getting mad because they wanted to know who, you know, he was bragging about giving money to veterans groups, raising money. So the reporters, as they should, said, well, who's getting the money? Simple facts, simple question. And he got very upset that they would dare ask him a question. I mean, that is not what you want in a president, no matter what party they are. And I think you're going to see more of that, and it's going to start to come out that this guy does not want to answer questions. He wants to belittle the press, and he wants to not live up to the same scrutiny that every other president has had to live up to and that they have to live up to. That's what the press does. They grill, they ask questions, they demand answers because the regular voter can't do it. That's why we're here. And if we're not able to do that, whether it's the press not doing it because they want to get ratings for easy things or they want to be lazy or they don't have the staff, which all three are true, or it's because the president or presidential nominee doesn't want to, that has to be reported as well. And that's one of the problems we're seeing. I think you're going to see more of that scrutiny. But the other point is, during the primaries, I don't think people should have been very surprised that Trump did get the support he did get, because there is such an angry element that's fed up with a lot of politics. And I think we've all seen that's part of the reason Bernie Sanders gets a lot of attention. Sort of two different factions of the same idea, that we're fed up with government, we're fed up with politics, we want these outsiders. Now, they're two very different outsiders, and Trump does lower himself to seek the lowest form of support through racism, misogyny, lies, pandering, name-calling, bullying. I mean, I live in New Jersey. We had a bullying governor, Chris Christie, who did the same thing, but it eventually backfired. He's one of the least liked politicians in New Jersey, even though he's got some national attention. Trump will only go so far with that, but it also is up to the press to continue to ask tough questions, ask Hillary Clinton tough questions as well, which they do. And another thing with Hillary Clinton is there's an underlying sexism in coverage of her that I don't think has gotten a lot of attention. We've done some things on it and we'll continue to do, but there are a lot of things that she's asked about and the way she's treated that I don't think a lot of men would get treated the same way. And again, this isn't her saying this. One of the falsehoods came out when Trump made it look like Hillary Clinton had asked people to vote for her because she's a woman, which never happened. Right. Now, there might be people who say, hey, I'd like to have a woman president. It'd be a great historic thing. She'd also be a good candidate for that. But to say she ever asked anyone, vote for me because I'm a woman, is another lie and somewhat of a sexist approach to her candidacy.
Well, it's always, you know, I think that the kind of subtle, deeply ingrained sexism is the type that's harder to spot. And the example that I always think about is like you have Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton all speaking, and people will say that she is the one whose voice is grating or is shrill or loud, when, you know, obviously Trump is the one of the most buffoonish of public speakers we've ever seen. So I wonder at the end of the day how media siloing, the tendency for liberals and conservatives to consume different media, will play into all of this. Like if the mainstream media covered Trump perfectly, according to my standards or Joe's standards, or those of, you know, other media watchdogs, I'm not sure how much of a difference it would make among Trump's potential supporters, given that they already think the media are awful. And in some sense, I almost think that the role that the conservative media end up playing is going to be more important for that particular audience. Joe, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you very much.
Folks, check out Joe Strupp's piece at MediaMatters.org. We'll be back with Imani Gandhi. Stay tuned.
This here's the story of Cassius Clay, who changed his name to Muhammad Ali. He knows how to talk and he knows how to fight, and all the contenders were beat out of sight. Sing Muhammad, Muhammad Ali. He floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee. Muhammad, the black Superman, who calls to the other guy. Catch me if you can. Now all you fight fans, you've got to agree, there ain't no flies on Muhammad Ali. He fills the arena wherever he goes, and everyone gets what they pay for. Muhammad was known to have said, you watch me shuffle, jab off your head. He moves like the black Superman and calls to the other guy, Ali. Catch me if you can. He says, I'm the greatest the world's ever seen, the heavyweight champion who came back again. My face is so pretty, you don't see a scar, which proves I'm the king of the ring by far. Sing Muhammad, Muhammad Ali. He floats like a butterfly and stings like a bee. Muhammad, the black Superman, who calls to the other guy. Catch me if you can.
We've been taking it easy. Suddenly, the moment came. Suddenly, the moment came. Watch it. And that was no banter. That was no banter fight. That was no banter punch. And he's down and out. However many times you look at that, it's the clearest punch you can see.
Catch me if you can. I'm Ali.
catch me if you can.
Welcome back to the show. Hey, by the way, I meant to mention during that last segment that only 40% of Americans say they have a fair amount or a great deal of confidence in the media. So it's not an institution that inspires a lot of trust. And if the media's coverage of Trump further erodes the public's confidence, well, that's not good. That's not good. Anyway, I'm always happy to welcome Imani Gandhi to the show. Imani is also known as the Angry Black Lady. She's a senior legal analyst for Rewire News, which was known as RH Reality Check the last time she appeared on the show. She's also, Imani, this is so complex. What's your title at This Week in Blackness?
I'm co-host of the flagship show, TWIB Prime.
And she's also co-host of the flagship show, TWIB Prime. Can I just call you Big Media Imani?
Sure. That's right. Big Media Imani. That's me.
Or Rupert Murdoch. What if I just leave you call you Rupert Murdoch?
I'd rather you didn't.
Next time you come on, I'm just going to introduce you as Rupert Murdoch and then leave the audience like totally confused, wondering what the hell's going on.
Right. Baffle your audience. Yeah.
Anywho, Imani Gandhi, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
So I have a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. First, bathroom bills and the freak out on the right about the Obama administration's directive. It's actually the Department of Education's. That schools allow people to go into the locker room of the gender they identify, the sex they identify. Well, let me ask you this. This strikes me, this whole thing about bathrooms, as the weirdest, silliest right-wing obsession I can remember. And it comes to us just as they've essentially lost the argument over gay rights, over marriage equality and adoption and all kinds of stuff. So are we going to be subjected to an ever weirder set of grievances as the religious right kind of struggles to remain relevant and raise money, or will they at some point just figure, okay, we can keep abortion going, let's drop all this other nonsense?
I actually think that conservatives, especially religious right conservatives, are really sort of alarmed at the what I like to call the cultural lawlessness of the Obama administration. And what I mean by that is we've seen a lot of strides made when it comes to LGBT rights over the last 7.5 years. And I think that the right wing is concerned that they are becoming the minority, that they are being overwhelmed by a bunch of lesbians and gays and bisexual people. And now there's these transgender people, right? I mean, there are people who were born one sex and then they think that they're another sex. And how weird is that? And when I was in high school, I wish I could have said that I feel like a girl so I could go into the locker room and look at boobs. I mean, I think that, you know, and I think that there's a fundamental failure to understand that this isn't something, it's not fun being trans. You know what I mean? Like trans people, they have a very high suicide rate. They have very high unemployment rate. They get assaulted, both physically and sexually assaulted at alarming rates. So this is not a matter of someone just deciding one day that they're going to be something else in order to gain some sort of sexual advantage over the opposite sex. These are people who fundamentally identify as a sex that they were not born with. And so I think that a lot of folks are just sort of confused. They don't get it. They feel like they just finally started getting used to gay people getting married. And now we have to talk about trans people using the bathroom. And I think a lot of people are just appalled at what they see as sort of the cultural wayward lawlessness that this country is going through.
Now, you know, I've had a few transgender people in my life, and all of them were, so they were outwardly, they were what they identified as, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this sense that, did you see, for example, the director of the Georgia American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of Georgia, she resigned today saying that her concerns about transgender rights weren't taken seriously. And she said this, and I have the quote here, "If we have all gender restrooms, which will accommodate trans folks, what do we do about women who are the survivors of rape for whom it would be traumatic to share a public restroom?" And this is a complete straw man, right? The way it works is that men will use the men's room, women will use the women's room, and it doesn't matter if they were born a different sex. What matters is their sex today.
Right.
Do you think that, like, they understand that they're writing laws that make manly men with facial hair and muscles go into the ladies' room?
I don't think that they do. I really don't think that they realize that they have for decades been using bathrooms with people they otherwise would not want to based on their, what I think is just rank transphobia. Right. I mean, it's, you know, and I think that you know, part of the problem of making that argument, though, is that it sort of privileges trans people who are able to pass over those who aren't, right? So a lot of the trans people who are able to pass, they're not the ones that are going to be harassed. It's the people who are, you know, mid-transition or people who don't express their gender, you know, express their femaleness or their womanness in a feminine way, right? Like they're not femmes. And so I think those are the people that are being harassed. Ironically, also, there are cis women, lesbians who are being harassed because they look butch.
And,
right?
even, I mean, and not even just lesbians.
And not even lesbians. There was that woman at Target who was harassed because she just cut up all her hair to give to like Locks for Love or something because to help cancer patients or whatever. So it's just this, I don't think these people have thought it through. I think to them, they feel like these are, you know, deviant sexual predators who are pretending to be women so that they can gain access to vulnerable men and to vulnerable women and girls in bathrooms. They don't view people, trans people, as the sex that they are, the gender that they are expressing, that they are identifying with. They refuse to acknowledge that. They refuse to see it. And so they've really backed themselves into a corner to where they're saying, okay, we want men with beards who are trans to start using women, to start using women's rooms? I mean, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
I mean, it's really very sad. I have some friends whose son recently transitioned. And when I first met their daughter years ago, she was incredibly depressed, right? She suffered really badly from being caught in a body that she didn't feel was hers. Mm-hmm. And when she transitioned, he is now a he, and it's amazing the way he has blossomed, right? Like he has a new job and he's just an incredibly happy, comfortable person.
Right.
And it's because he was able to transition because his parents are progressive enough to have supported him in that, right? That was really important. Mm-hmm. And it's just tragic. And I think going back to this ACLU director, right? This is the director of the ACLU. Have we been caught on the back foot with the bathroom stuff as far as narrative goes here? It seems like this is pretty effective for them.
I think what's really interesting, and obviously I'm not going to accuse the director of the ACLU of being conservative, but there are groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom that have put out these videos where they talk to sexual assault survivors and talk about how much they fear being in the bathroom with, you know, with a man or with someone who has a penis or used to have a penis. What I find really interesting about that argument is that they are co-opting a very progressive argument, right? Because for the past couple of years, we've been having this national conversation about rape culture and about believing women and about trusting survivors. And conservatives generally about trigger warnings, about feeling comfortable in college campuses. And conservatives tend to be really averse to that, right? They tend to be very much in the realm of, oh, you're being so politically correct. Why do we need to have trigger warnings in school? So now what they're saying is, well, we want trigger warnings in bathrooms, but trigger warnings aren't their thing. So I think it's really interesting that they're co-opting left, you know, very progressive left arguments to make a case that doesn't even really make sense in the first place, but that sounds sensible enough and sounds like it should have some weight simply because we on the left do care about survivors and care about sexual assault and care about rape culture. So I think that's an interesting tactic that they've taken on. I don't think they're being genuine about it. And as I said earlier, I think it's just a fundamental misunderstanding about what being trans means.
Yes.
And if they would just take the time to talk to a trans person, you know, use the white man's Google to figure out what trans is, then that way they will be able to address this issue in a more compassionate and empathetic way.
And I think we need to see more people like my friends who are the parents of trans kids. There was a great column by John Ralston, who was actually on the show recently, about his kid, about realizing that his kid was trapped in the wrong sex body. And I think that just as gay people coming out was really important for advancing LGBT rights, I would like to see more people, you know, who are dealing with these issues and whose lives are success stories, like my friend's son, mm-hmm. out there showing the human side of it, because that's the real thing. I had never met a trans person until I moved to San Francisco. That's the truth.
Yeah.
And then I had a trans roommate and two coworkers, and then I got a very different perspective from it based on personal experience. Personal experience goes a very long way, you know? I mean, I the same kind of thing, like, I've always been really hostile to Islamophobia because I've, by sheer coincidence, had a lot of Muslims in my life, you know? And right. they're normal people. They, you know, they drink and hook up their cafeteria Muslims, you know, like cafeteria Catholics. And knowing people really does make a big difference. So, all right, everyone on the right is freaking out about this Department of Education guidance.
Right.
Tyranny and mom jeans and all of that. Lots of jerk. What's your take on the claim that the administration is overstepping its bounds? Like, give us some of that sweet legal analysis.
That sweet legal analysis. So this is relates to two statutes. One is Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. One is Title IX of the 1972 U.S. Education Amendments. Title IX is the provision that protects, that prohibits sex discrimination in schools. And Title VII prohibits sex discrimination in the workplace. But they're kind of like sister statutes. So from a legal perspective, they're both analyzed using similar principles. So what this all comes down to, what it will come down to, is whether or not there's a principle of law called agency deference, right? So when you're dealing with administrative law, and that's what Title VII and Title IX are. Title VII is administered by the EEOC. Title IX by the Department of Education. Generally, under the Administrative Procedures Act, an agency is entitled to interpret its implementing regulations, meaning the regulations that are passed and that are issued that sort of complement the statute that was the basis for the formation of that particular agency. So those agencies are allowed to implement their own regulations, issue their own regulations, and then when they do so, they're allowed to interpret their own regulations, as long as their interpretation is not, quote unquote, plainly erroneous, meaning that it's obviously wrong. So what we have here is we have a situation where Congress passed these laws. And back in 1964 and 1972, there really was no conversation about what sex means. Congress didn't have hearings about what sex means. Transgender people weren't on their radar. So the argument of these bathroom discriminators is that, well, Congress obviously didn't mean for sex to include gender identity, because if they had meant that, they would have included that. But the problem with that is that there's no legislative history either way. And so because of this principle of agency deference, that means that the Department of Education and the EEOC are permitted to interpret the term sex pretty much any way they want to. And so they've interpreted sex to include gender identity. And with respect to the workplace, this stems from a seminal case in 1986 called Price Waterhouse v. Hopkins. And in that case, Ann Hopkins was the plaintiff. She was a consultant at Price Waterhouse, and she was up for promotion, but she was told by the higher-ups, the male higher-ups, that she wasn't feminine enough, that she was too macho. And so they told her that she should wear more skirts and, you know, style her hair differently and wear makeup. And so she sued, saying that this was discrimination on the basis of sex. And up until that point, the way you express your gender was not considered discrimination on the basis of sex. But the Supreme Court said in this case, well, now it is, you know, because the reason that she was fired is because, or the reason that she didn't get the promotion is because she expressed her gender in a manner that was contrary to these arbitrary societal standards that we have held, you know, these sort of madmen societal standards. And so because that has been deemed to be discrimination on the basis of sex, the Obama administration believes that gender identity, trans people, that falls under discrimination on the basis of sex, because being trans is essentially expressing your gender in a manner that is contrary to these arbitrary societal standards. Now, the issue is, and it's going to get a little bit technical, but there are two sort of categories of rules under the Administrative Procedures Act. One are legislative rules, and these are rules like the contraception mandate, right? So the Affordable Care Act was passed, but there was no contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act. It was a regulation that was later issued by the Department of Health and Human Services. And because it's a legislative rule, meaning that people need to follow this rule as a matter of law, that those rules need to be put up for public comment. It's called a notice and comment period. And it's usually 30 days or maybe 60 days, and it gives the public an opportunity to review the rule, to make any concerns or comments that they have about the rule, so the agency can go back and look at what the public feels about this particular rule and either amend it or revise it to accommodate those feelings. So that's a legislative rule. The second category of rule is called an interpretive rule. And interpretive rules don't have the force of law. They're just guidance documents, right? And so that's what this guidance, that's what this the Obama administration, the quote unquote, dear colleague letter that they issue to all of these school boards and states and school boards, that's what that is. It's just interpreting what they think the law already requires. So
which
the Obama administration
doesn't need an approval period, right?
Exactly. And so interpretive rules do not need to go through a public notice and comment period. And so the question then becomes, what is this guidance now? I mean, obviously the Obama administration is going to call it an interpretive rule so that they don't have to go through the comment period. But what a court, I think, is going to have to decide is whether or not it is an interpretive rule or a legislative rule. And if it's just an interpretive rule, then quite frankly, people are just going to have to deal with it. I mean,
just
it means trans
it
people just suck it up. Exactly. So that's sort of the legal background. And interestingly, the fact that Scalia died actually helps the Obama administration in their effort to extend the protections of Title VII and Title IX to trans people, because Justice Scalia was the author of an opinion called Auer v. Robinson. It's A-U-E-R. That plus another decision from 1945, those are the two decisions that stand for the proposition that agencies are entitled to interpret their own implementing regulations and implementing statutes however they see fit. Now, he wrote that opinion, I believe it was in 1991, I want to say 1991, but since then, he expressed a lot of doubt about whether or not that was the proper way to go, because there were a lot of concerns about separation of power and federalism, and we shouldn't be allowing agencies to write their own rules and interpret their own rules, because then they're just going to be lawless. And so there, and Justice Roberts believes the same thing, Alito, and Thomas. And so in various opinions over the years, they've all expressed a desire to revisit this agency deference rule in a case that's appropriate for it. And we just had a case that was appropriate for it. It was called Brianna Bible versus the United States Student Aid Fund, I believe. Essentially, it was a woman who was suing about some student debt that she owed and whether or not the Department of Education was permitted to interpret regulations such that because she was a first-time borrower, a first-time defaulter, the guarantee agency, the people that issued her debt or the people that issued her the loan and that to whom she owed this money, they weren't allowed to sort of do what they wanted to do and impose all of these collections fees just willy-nilly. And so the court, the lower court said, well, the Department of Education, they implemented these rules, they've interpreted these rules, they say that she's a first-time defaulter and you cannot assess all of these collection fees. And the Supreme Court declined to take up that case. And that would have been a perfect case for five conservative justices to just do away with this agency deference rule. And if they had done that, then the Obama administration would have been in a pickle because they would no longer have been permitted to say, well, you know, the EEOC can do what it wants. The DOE can do what it wants. The court would have said, no. We are going to, you know, exercise our judicial review and tell you whether or not your guidance document is something that, you know, all of these states and school boards have to follow, or if you've overstepped your bounds. So, you know, it's kind of fortuitous. I hate to, you know, gloat about someone's death.
No, you don't. We're talking about Scalia. Don't lie to me, Amal.
I have no comment. But the point is that it has been very helpful because you've got this 4-4 split and, you know, and Scalia was a very, very strong personality.
Yes.
And I imagine had he been alive, the court would have taken up that case because there would have been 4 votes to grant cert to basically agree to hear the case. And who knows what would have happened? They might have been able to convince, you know, Justice Kennedy, who also expressed a little bit of concern about agency deference in a case a couple few years ago. They might have been able to get him to come over to their side. So a lot of this is going to depend on how the courts view these particular rules, whether or not they're legislative or they're interpretive. And the rights of trans people are, as always, as the rights of all oppressed minorities tend to be, are in the hands of the Supreme Court.
All right. So if I can review, this all goes back to help, I'm being repressed versus shut up, sit on it, and rotate. And then,
yeah, that's the legal terminology. Yeah, rotate.
And then, do you regret not having a mic to drop because you left the mic in the office?
I do. I actually do.
That was a boom mic drop thing. And then finally, so if they were to get, if they were to rid us of agency deference, would that not lead to chaos, specifically that you have thousands and thousands of people in these agencies who have expertise that Congress does not have, and Congress does not write legislation that is so densely, thickly detailed that it can anticipate every possible thing that could come up?
Like, right.
How does that work in the real world?
It would be chaos. It would be chaos. And, you know, and this is a rule that's been in place since 1945. I mean, the opinion that Scalia wrote was, I believe, in 1991. But this is a very old rule stemming from 1945. So it would upend a lot of the way that agencies operate. And, you know, I don't think that we want, especially this crop of Congress people, deciding what, you know, the Congress people in 1964 meant when they added discrimination on the basis of sex. And it's just, at the end of the day, it's just common sense. Trans people are, you know, to borrow some language from equal protection analysis, they are a discrete and insular minority. They don't have the political clout to prevent these sorts of bathroom discrimination bills from being passed. They are not extended protection either. They're not extended protection that is normally extended to quote unquote suspect classes, you know, classes based on race, classes based on sex and that and things of that nature, when they absolutely should be. It just, it makes common sense that trans people, including lesbian, gays, and bisexual, are a suspect class. But the only court to say that trans people are a suspect class is a district court in New York. So we're sort of waiting for whether or not that case will make it to the Supreme Court, or what case involving LGBT rights is going to make it to the Supreme Court and force the court to engage in a serious and substantial equal protection analysis such that any laws that discriminate against LGBT people will require either strict or intermediate scrutiny, depending upon what level of whether they're a suspect class or a quasi-suspect class.
So if you think that there's not that much at stake in this election, you are an idiot. Is that right?
You are an absolute idiot. You are just, I mean, you should really be just shot from a cannon into the sun, because it's this election. And I feel like it seems like every election since 2008, we've been saying, oh my God, the Supreme Court, because those justices are really old. And they've been really old for like 10 or 15 years. But now they're really, really, really old, you know, to the point where there are about four of them who are either going to kick the bucket or retire. And we cannot allow Donald Trump to be the person in charge of appointing four justices, because then what we'll have is an entirely conservative right-wing court, and it will be a nightmare for anyone who's not a cis white man.
Even for cis white people, there's going to be lots of problems.
Yeah.
And I'll say this, you know, there's also the Paris agreement. If the next president is able to quash all of these executive orders by which Obama has achieved significant commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, it's going to be a disincentive for other countries to ratchet up their commitments.
Yeah.
And we're just going to set the whole world on fire. Imani, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. You are, as always, an excellent explainer of these things, and I really do appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
I also want to thank Joe Strupp. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank Digby for letting me keep the show over at her place, Crooks and Liars for letting me host it at theirs. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Don't you stop.